So Hare Krishna, and I want to thank all of you for making this great sacrifice of coming all the way over here. That's one sacrifice. And the other one is to come over here on such a cold morning again. This always encourages me. Because, as you know, the purpose of this class is to really, explain this. By the way, I have no idea where Bhaktivedanta Maharaj is, right? I don't know why. And the boys also, they're not here. So, no answer to that. Don't ask me. I hope they show up. But as I was saying last year when we started this in the first canto, that in this course we aim not really to arrive at some degree or, you know, official stamp, but that we, all of us, arrive at the heart of the Srimad Bhagavatam as much as possible. As much as possible. For us unfortunate conditioned souls of this age. And so therefore this class is not structured really around time. It's structured around Krishna. Krishna's time, of course. But it's structured around Krishna Katha and hopefully a deepening appreciation, deepening realization. Jai Maharaj. Please excuse me for starting without you.
No, that's fine.
Yes, our hope is that we can deepen everyone's appreciation in the katha of the Bhagavata. And the katha includes everything. So in our study of the Srimad Bhagavatam, we are not going to leave any stone unturned. As I've said, I think I've said this a number of times, but Prabhupada said repetition is one of our basic principles of education. That there are many devotees, when they read the Srimad Bhagavatam, when they get to those parts that seem too technical or philosophical or just too deep or, you know, remote from how we understand the world today through our senses and experience, then they have a tendency just to, you know, read as fast as they can, turn the pages, and then get to the next lila, you know, the next nectar. And of course, we're not here. When we get to the nectarian lila parts, we're going to examine them just as carefully as we're examining the second canto, so don't worry about that. But Bhagavatam begins as a commentary on, it is, the whole Bhagavatam is a commentary on Vedanta Sutra, and that is especially apparent in the first two cantos, in which, and third canto, and fourth canto, yeah, fifth canto also, actually all the way through, but as you progress through the Bhagavatam also, as you get fourth canto, there's the wonderful lila, for example, of Maharaj Dhruva. More and more lila katha comes through. And then, of course, when we get to the tenth canto, that's the summum bonum of Krishna lila katha. So all of that is commentary on Vedanta, but the Bhagavatam begins specifically, it's as if you've turned the final page of Srila Vyasadeva's Vedanta Sutra, and then Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, you're beginning with his own bhasya, his own commentary on the four chapters of Vedanta. That's the way the Bhagavatam reads. So I also want to apologize for not having been here on Tuesday. I really intended to come, but Monday I had a whole day planned out of work, and because of some minor problem with my backup hard disk on my computer and a few other minor things. See, minor things in India, by the nature of this place, can turn, you know, there are things that in the West you get finished in 20 minutes, but somehow in India they can take 4 or 5 hours. So I was riding all over my poor my bicycle, going here, there, knocking on doors, trying to find people just to get simple things done, and watching that whole plan of my day go down the drain. And by the end of, as the sun was going down, I was totally, I'd finished everything, but I was totally exhausted physically and mentally. And so I just went to my room, and I wanted to start working, but I just, as they say, crashed out, fell asleep. I woke up at midnight and I was sick. I had a sore throat. And I continued to try to work some more. But I fell back to sleep. And then when I opened my eyes, I noticed that it was 8:15. I knew Maharaj would be here conducting class. And I would have to get up and take a shower. And then by the time, you know, class would be over, so there was no point in me trying to come, so I just sent a note, excuse myself. So, we do have this final part, if our study guides are matching up at last. This will begin on page 17. But before that, because on that Tuesday early morning, when I woke up with a sore throat, but still was determined I'm going to come to the class. I had some ideas about about how to illustrate the necessity of receiving Shastra through Guru Parampara. And I want to show you this in the form of, it's just a little exercise I wrote out on a piece of paper. Not even exercise, just something to look at. I'm going to just pass it around, all of you can have a look. Well, I can show you from here. You see, there are two long words. Now, what the top word is an English sentence which is written the way Sanskrit is written. In other words, one difference is at least the vowels are shown, but in Sanskrit there's no problem of recognizing where vowels are because it's implicit in the Devanagari. But there are no commas, there are no any... What do you call it?
Punctuation.
Punctuation, yeah. No punctuation marks. And the words are not separated. So in many... You look at original Sanskrit texts, even the Srimad Bhagavatam, you know, Prabhupada, in his Romanized... When he Romanizes it, puts it in Romanized language, then he'll separate them into words with hyphens, but those hyphens are not in the original Sanskrit. And sometimes, you know, you'll see verses that are practically just one long word, you know, or maybe two. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think the Vedas are even much more so like this, because they're very long prose compositions, or prose poetic, but I mean very lengthy. And this is the glory of, on one side, the glory of the Sanskrit language, because these are not really just one, you know, long, long words. They are sentences, but you can break them up in different ways, and you can derive from one Sanskrit sentence many meanings. And so for poetry, and Srimad Bhagavatam is poetry. It's beautiful. But for philosophy, it can be a bit of a problem. I'll give you an example. The so-called Mahavakya, which Srila Prabhupada, even in one place, says is the Mahamantra of the Mayavadis, is a sentence taken, it's not a sentence actually, it's a phrase taken out of a larger Upanishadic sentence. I believe it's Udalika speaking to Svetaketu, where the father tells his son, Tattvamasi, that thou are the same, you are the same as that Brahman. So the traditional Mahavakya of the Vedas is Om. I'm going to also be explaining to you Om from the Vaishnava Pancharatrik point of view, which you will find very interesting, I hope, because we've been speaking of the Vyuhas, and so all of that is included in the... But that'll come in a minute. So when it comes to philosophy, then you get into controversies. Shankaracharya, of course, Tattvamasi is not the Mahavakya, first of all. That is already what is called Gauna, not Mukya. Mukya, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, and this is what makes it easy for us, that in our parampara, by the order of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Vaishnavacharyas, Jiva Goswami, whose commentary we're reading from extensively, they follow the mukya or direct understanding of the words. And they don't... Sometimes they will refer to the gauna, that means the indirect or poetic, bringing it back to the mukya. It's called alankar, embellishment. But they don't just follow the gauna into some, you know, what's called terra incognita, unknown realm of philosophy, where, you know, personalism disappears and impersonalism becomes more and more the predominating factor, which is what Shankaracharya did. So Shankaracharya, he took that tattva-masvi, you are the same, which of course in Veda, Aveda, Tattva, Achincha, Aveda, Aveda, Tattva, there is a proper way of understanding that we are the same as the Lord. In essence, Prabhupada would say, in quality, but not in quantity. In quantity, then that is Aveda. We are different. We are tiny sparks of the same essence that is Krishna, Chit Shakti. It is, of course, there are three, Sat, Chit, Ananda, or Sandini, Samvit is Chit Shakti, and then Hladini. And it's explained by the Acharyas that although all three constitute Krishna, Krishna in particular is the Samvit Shakti. In particular, he takes that position as Purush to enjoy both Sandini, his Dham, and the Hladini, Srimati, who is personified as Srimati Radharani. So he takes this middle position. And the Jiva is said to be an expansion of that Chit Shakti. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains that we have the potentiality of Hladini Shakti, for example, by the grace of Bhakti Devi, if we take up Krishna consciousness very nicely, then we can become endowed with the contact with these Shaktis of the spiritual Krishna's own Shaktis that he's forever enjoying. So anyway, to get back to the point, Madhvacharya, in his reply, because Madhvacharya appeared simply, as Prabhupada said, give a very nice example from Chaitanya Charitamrita. There's this word Vedanta, which here's a good example of what I'm talking about. The Mukhya definition of Vedanta is end of the Vedas. Veda, Anta. But the Gauna, poetic definition, which is especially embodied or personified by Madhvacharya, is to knock someone's teeth out. Danta means teeth. So if you leave someone toothless, you know, without teeth in their head, because you've given them a good punch right in the mouth, and scattered their teeth all over the floor. I talk like this because I know how to do these things. I'm always trying to control. But I'm getting better. little glimpse into my hot furnace of my life. So you leave someone toothless. And in Sanskrit that can be called Vedanta, a person who has no teeth left. So Madhvacharya, because at that time the Shankaras, the Advaitas, they had the corner, the market corner on Vedantism. They were known as the Vedantists. They didn't even have to designate themselves as Advaita Vedantists. They were the Vedantists. So Madhvacharya came and just punched them out and left them toothless. And he established his Dvaita Vedantism. Ramanuja also came to do that, but it is said because of Ramanuja's philosophy being, the name of it is Vashishta Advaita. So because he left in that Advaita, Madhvacharya appeared to establish Dvaita. That's why he's always shown, he's very muscular. He was actually Vayu and Hanuman, incarnation of Mukhya Prana, Vayu and Hanuman together. So he's very stout-bodied, very bold, fearless, and he would hold up as a mudra, two fingers, to mean there is God, Brahman, and there is Jiva. And these Madhvas, I've met them in Udupi, they go so far as to say that that if you say Aham Brahmasmi, then you're a Mayavadi. Because we do say Aham Brahmasmi, don't we? I am not the body, I am the spirit. They don't like to hear that. They don't like to hear any Jiva say Aham Brahmasmi, because Brahman means Krishna. You see, and we are pratibimba, we are reflections or we are emanations, but we should never even use the word Brahman for ourselves. So that's, they go a little far. So concerning this tattvamasi, Madhvacharya, in his reply to that, he broke the sentence spoken by Udalika differently. He broke the words differently so that it comes out atattvamasi. And that's possible. You see? So actually, then Udalika is saying, I am not the same. And I had a talk, you know, just to make sure, because I'm not pretending, I don't mean to pretend to be a Sanskrit scholar, although I am, in my own way, learning a lot about this language now. So I checked this all out with Bhagish probably yesterday. So this is one of the, when it comes to philosophy, one of the problems about the Shastra. This is why we have to receive Shastra through Guru Parampara, because they actually tell us what the words are that we should be reading in the verses and what they mean. What is their straightforward meaning? And Prabhupada does say in Bhagavatam, there are some parts that are, instead of being straightforward literal narratives, are what's called paroksha artha, like the narrative of King Puranjan, which is in the fourth canto, which is told by Narada Muni to King Pratinibarhi. So Narada Muni is actually, he's preaching to King Pratinibarhi. There is no King Puranjan. Puranjan is an invention of Narada Muni. But there's a whole story. And it's very intricate, very involved. But it's, Prabhupada himself says in his purport that it is not literal history. But yet, at the same time, Prabhupada says it is truth. And we are to understand it as such. And that reminds me of a phrase or a statement which I found to be very true. That people read the newspapers to get the truth and all they get is lies. And then when you pick up a book of very good fiction, written by these, the best, they're very excellent fiction writers. We can start with India. Prabhupada spoke of Kalidas, who wrote Kumar Sambhava. He wrote about the birth of Kartikeya, Skanda. So that is a novel, actually. It's not a Purana. It's Puranic information. It's all based on Purana, but it's written in a very beautiful, poetic, novelic form by a great writer called Kalidas. Sanatana Goswami wrote a novel. You know the name of it? Brihad Bhagavatamrita. Yeah, it's a novel, but everything in it you'll find it. You know, as far as the tattva, the truth, you'll find in the Bhagavatam. But we, in other words, the understanding is that Gop Kumar, who is the hero of Brihad Bhagavatamrita, is not to be taken as an actual historical personality. He is a symbolic representation of every one of us. Every jiva is actually an eternal devotee of Krishna. That is who Gop Kumar is. So, as I said, there's this English saying that people read the newspaper to get the truth and all they get is lies. The newspapers are famously full of lies and distortions. And I've actually been told that by one person actually told me this, that he spent some time once, he had some time in his life, I think he was working in journalism, where he was able to check out for some period many, many newspaper articles on different events. And he said he didn't find one that actually told the whole truth, you know, as they say, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. There's always some misinformation, disinformation, even out and out lies, distortions, just put in by the author of the piece. So people read newspapers, you see them every, Prabhupada often writes about this, you know, on the trains going to work in the morning. They read newspapers thinking they're getting the world situation and they're just being lied to. But when you reach for a book of very good fiction, and Srila Prabhupada used to, for example, quote Shakespeare. Now, Shakespeare is all famously fictional, or it's dramatic. But Prabhupada used to quote Brahmananda Prabhu knows all of them. He used to hear Prabhupada quote them. This was in the very early days of preaching. He used to quote, Prabhupada knew Shakespeare very well. And so he used to quote a lot of lines from Shakespeare. So that's the irony that a work of fiction is understood from the start that in one sense this isn't true. But because the author is reaching so deep inside of his conscious experience of life. And because, as Prabhupada said about Western philosophers, their sincerity is their Krishna consciousness. If he's sincere, he can bring out in his so-called fiction more truth than you'll get in the newspaper, more truth about the human condition than you'll get in newspapers. So anyway, that was another one of my famous footnotes. It doesn't go anywhere. So what I want to do is just pass around. You can just pass this around. What you get at the top here is an English sentence. As I said, it's all run together. the letters are not separated as we normally separate them. It's constructed as a Sanskrit sentence might be constructed. No punctuation marks. And then, secondly, underneath it, there's the same sentence with all the vowels removed. Why did I do this? Because many of us in this class, those of you who are not, especially those who are not coming from India, coming from outside of India, many of you will likely have a Christian or Jewish background, and so you, or maybe just atheistic, but if you grew up with any religion, it would have been the Holy Bible, as they call it. So the Holy Bible, the Old Testament, is written in Hebrew. And Hebrew is a language with no vowels. So that's why the interpretation of Hebrew scriptures is, you know, it's a big thing. Rabbis, councils of rabbis have to come together because they're just working with consonants. And you've probably heard of Kabbalah, which is Jewish mysticism. This is where they convert the letters to numbers, and then they get the meaning, the real meaning of what the scripture is saying, by some form of esoteric numerology. So it's someone, a Jewish devotee, drew my attention to the relationship between the word Kabbalah and Kapila, because Kapila Muni gave the Sankhya philosophy, and Sankhya literally means to count, to use numbers. And of course this was his theory, but he was quite learned in Jewish, the Hebrew scriptures, as well as being a devotee. So this was his private theory, that Kabbalah was a form of Sankhya philosophy, because he says this is what the rabbis do. They turn all the letters to numbers, and then they by numerology work out the meaning. So I put the same English sentence without any vowels, so you can see what that looks like. And then I put two beneath that, interpretations out of this top sentence with the vowels. I haven't even bothered to do anything with the second sentence. I just wanted to show you what it looks like without vowels. You know, that's the Old Testament. That's the Old Testament version of the sentence above. And then I've given two possible ways of breaking up this sentence. And then each one of these two possible ways of reading this sentence has different meanings. It can be read in different ways. So I just want to, here, I'll give this to you. You can just please take a quick look. We'll continue talking. Just pass it around. I hope my handwriting doesn't, I tried to print it out as well as I could. And this will help you, I hope, to appreciate better why we are so fortunate to be connected to Guru Parampara, so that we are told actually by Krishna himself through the authorized line how to understand the Shastra. Because understanding the Shastra is not simply a question of understanding, you know, jargon, esoteric words, philosophical. It's not like reading philosophy, you know, a difficult philosophical text in the English language. I read a lot of philosophy. So that's also difficult to read because you don't know what the, but you can always reach for a dictionary and look up the word and you can get a basic idea. But I told you already about language, meta-language. Here we are, we're using the meta-language of English to talk about the message of the Srimad Bhagavatam in the Sanskrit language. And if we had to go directly to the Sanskrit, what I'm showing you there is just a little drop in the ocean that we'd find ourselves in. You know, to study this Bhagavatam, we all had to learn Sanskrit, read it directly, and without, you know, as scholars do, without the guidance of a spiritual master. Academics do this, I remember I was on the BBT library party. I remember I met the American professor who had translated Chaitanya Charitamrita. That was back in the early 70s, so he was wearing a flowered shirt, and he had a florid mustache and a kind of Beatles haircut. And yeah, I translated the Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's kind of, oh, that's very interesting. Glad I haven't read it. Because what, you know, kind of interpretation, having been on the library party and talked to these people, I heard some of those insane interpretations of the Vedic scriptures and also of Chaitanya Charitamrita. I don't even want to repeat them. They're really malecha type explanations. So this just gives you a little hint. So I just hope that helps you to appreciate the shower of mercy that we're all under, that we're all in this wonderful family of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, created by the great world acharya of modern times, His Divine Grace, Sesi Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Ki jai! Now, to the next point, we have been speaking to you about Aniruddha, Pradyumna, Sankarshan, and Vasudev. So, I'd like to summarize that by explaining to you the word Om from the Vaishnava Pancharatra. Particularly, there's one Pancharatra which is known as the Lakshmi Tantra, which is bona fide in the list of bona fide Vaishnava Pancharatras, but it belongs to the Sri Sampradaya, the Lakshmi Sampradaya. And it's a very, very interesting work to read alongside Srimad Bhagavatam, because it's Lakshmi as the Lord Shakti explaining what she does in creation. You see, it's very, very interesting, because in the Bhagavatam we're getting it from the Bhagavata point of view, the Lord's point of view, that the Lord does this, the Lord does this, the Lord does this. In Lakshmi Tantra, Lakshmi is saying, I do this, I do this, I do this for the Lord. And there, it's actually a very beautiful scripture in which she sometimes stops and she just starts to glorify the different forms of the Lord that she's serving, like these four vyuhas, how beautiful they are. And so she's really speaking as a chaste, loving wife, all the service that she's doing. But it's the Lakshmi Tantra. And you've all heard this word, and there's a kind of, a shadow over this term Tantra, because there are Tantras. Basically, people, especially in the West, they understand Tantra, Tantra as it is known as the mode of ignorance. Tantra literally means the weave, how the esoteric process, how creation is woven together, and also explains how one should worship the Lord using ingredients from the creation. This is our tantra, the puja, which you see in the temple. This is our tantra, Vaishnava tantra. I'm talking about the point of view of Vedic science. If you Vedically, scientifically analyze the arti that's being done, you'll see that all the elements, the Pancha Mahabhutas, and then the three subtle elements are being offered to the Lord during the arti. We're offering water, earth in the form of foodstuffs and flowers, and these are all products of earth. We're offering water, we're offering fire, we're offering air, we're offering ether when we pronounce mantras, because sound is simply the manifest form of ether. And we're supposed to offer our minds, intelligence, and our, it's finally, prapati. Prapati means complete surrender. That's how you cross over the false ego. You completely surrender yourself to Krishna. So in that way, we offer up the false ego to the Lord too. So this is in... So we do... We're tantrics also. See? 6 times a day over in a temple, there's a mysterious tantric ceremony going on called arti. But this is in the mode of Vasudeva Sattva, actually. It is transcendental. It is not even the mode of goodness, which is ordinary mode of goodness is worship of demigods, the higher demigods. And then you come down to Rajaguna worship, which could include worship of demons even, and then finally Tamoguna worship, which is worship of ghosts, and the Dasha Mahabhijas. There are 10 forms of Devi, very interesting forms, like Chamundi, who cuts off her own head and then holds her head out with her hand, and the blood spouting from her neck, she drinks. Imagine worshipping a deity like that. Well, there are certain tantrics who do. So this Lakshmi Tantra is called, is a tantric scripture, but it's called Tantra. And the reason is because Lakshmi warns herself in this work that if you read this work looking for me, and she's the chastity of Goddess Lakshmi is incomparable. So she writes, she states, she's speaking to Indra. She says, if you read this work looking for me, you will not find me. You'll find only ignorance. So what she's saying is, you may read this work, but you look for the Lord. Even though the way she's speaking is, you know, she's doing all the creation because she's the Shakti of the Lord. But she says, if you read this work looking for the Shakti, in other words, looking as the because Prabhupada, the tantrics are also known as the Shaktas. And Prabhupada one purport says, the Shaktas and the Bhaktas, the devotees of the Lord, are always in opposition. So she says, if you use this work to be a Shakta, then you will never attain me, you will never find me, you will only enter ignorance. And very early on in the form in Lakshmi Tantra, she, in the beginning of creation, she speaks of her form as Goddess Tamasi. And then she gives, after introducing Goddess Tamasi and the description, which is frightening actually, and then she gives the names, different names of Goddess Tamasi, and one of the names is Mahakali. So, in other words, she's saying, this is what you're going to find. If you read this Vaishnava Tantra, but if you read it looking for me, you're going to end up in the Tamaguna, worshipping Goddess Kali like all the Tamasic Tantrics do. So that's called the Vama Marg, left-hand path. See, Srimati Radharani is on the left. You see in India, there are so many people who worship Lakshmi, either alone, they just have the picture of Lakshmi, or they, next to her they put Ganesh. Why do they put Ganesh? Because he's the remover of obstacles. So they want Ganesh there to remove any obstacles to getting Lakshmi. So these people are actually, they call themselves Hindus, and they present themselves as, but they're no better than Ravana. Philosophically speaking, they are no better than Ravana, because they want sometimes when they're Vaishnavas, then you'll see Narayan next to Lakshmi. But go to Calcutta, look in so many stores on the altar, that's what you'll see. Well, not only Lakshmi, you'll see, often see a lot of other pictures of persons I don't even want to mention. Had nothing to do with Vedic knowledge or culture, but present themselves as such. So anyway, let me just explain Om according to Lakshmi Tantra. You'll find this very interesting in the light of what we've been speaking about. So, as you know, first of all, I should say Jiva Goswami explains Om in a very, I don't mean simple in the terms of simplistic, but straightforward. Straightforward according to the principal tenets of Vaishnava philosophy, where A, because Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita of letters, I am A. So Krishna is A, U is Srimati Radharani, and M is the Jiva. So in that understanding of Om, you have Achincha Beda Abheda Tattva philosophy, you know, compressed into three letters. So in Lakshmi Tantra, we get the Vyuha explanation of Om. And since that's what we've been talking about, I would like to share that with you. So, A stands for Aniruddha, who is of the Vyuhas, the Lord of the material Sattva Guna and the Lord of the Jagrata phase of consciousness, wakeful phase of consciousness. U stands for Pradyumna. You hear the U in the name Pradyumna. And of course he is the Lord of Rajaguna and presides over the Svapna, dreaming state. And I told you that human consciousness is basically a 24-hour a day. Prabhupada said that. Have you heard that? That Prabhupada has said human life is daydream, nightdream. You all remember having heard that? He said it in lectures several times. I think it's well known. And this is the nature of our svabhava as human beings is rajasic. And so we are always dreaming, even when we're so-called awake. Very, very few people are actually awake. Just watch your own mind and you'll see. You see? You're always thinking of something in the past, in the future, reflecting, wondering, you know, speculating, this, that. The mind is always... And that means you're dreaming. Jagrata means to be fully awake and attentive on... This is true regulation. When one becomes truly regulated, well, this is why we stress in Krishna consciousness, becoming regulated, because the intention is to regulate ultimately the mind, to actually bring the mind to the state of wakefulness. And then from there you can get to, that's mode of goodness, and from there you can get to Vasudeva Sattva. So this wakefulness is actually dhyana, it's meditation, it's akayana, it's the fixing of the mind on the Lord and nothing else. It doesn't mean that you're not thinking of anything else, that your mind is just empty except for Krishna. But everything is centered only on Krishna. But I don't think any of us here can truthfully raise our hands if I were, you know, to ask the question, do you think of Krishna 24 hours a day? Mm-hmm. Truthfully, I don't think anybody here, I don't think anybody in this room at this time can raise their hand. You know, deep sleep at night in Shushupti, are you thinking of Krishna then, you know? So anyway, Pradyumna, he is you. And then M is Sankarsana. We can say Sankarsana or Samkarsana. So the M, Om, refers to Lord Sankarsan, Mahavishnu, who is also known as Tamasa, because the jivas are asleep within him. And he is the presiding lord over, in the creative lila, the mode of ignorance. Then, so you have these three letters, A, U, M, and they come together in that one famous Vita Blackford. I draw it for you, but I think you've all seen it many times. It looks like one letter, but it's a combination of three letters. But above it, there's Chandra. It's a moon, but it's a moon like as seen in the hair of Lord Shiva. It's this way, not this way. Usually we see the moon, the crescent moon, you know, sort of like this way, or like in the Muslims' flags, they have moon and they have goddess Ishtar, although the Muslims will never admit it, but from ancient Babylonia, goddess Ishtar, Venus.